Hello and welcome to another edition of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
And I'm Lisa Baltz. Hi, Brian.
Hi. It's been a week, so time to do another one of these. And as always, no shortage of topics to talk about. Before we get into the serious sports topics, I hope people noticed that last week on the podcast, we actually had a photo of a real bandwagon.
Oh, yes. There. Yes. And Brian chose that photo. I actually made him choose the picture. And we'll probably find another one for you. But if we do decide to continue on with this pilot podcast, I think I'm going to commission some artwork. I have an idea.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. So.
But you hear the term the bandwagon, and that's, you know, the sports fans jump on the bandwagon, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I was like, well, what really is a bandwagon? Well, a bandwagon apparently was with the circus when it came through town, and there was a wagon with the band on it that was the bandwagon, and that's what we had a photo of on the
podcast. I guess if you really wanted to party, you could jump onto the bandwagon and join right in, which is kind of what we're asking you to do. And as we've mentioned, we love input, your feelings about whatever it is we're talking about or good or bad, I suppose, especially on Twitter. And you can find me on Twitter at Lisa Baltz.
I'm at B Moline, W-I-L-L. So chime in there with us and let us know what you think. Some interesting topics this week.
Just a few. I was actually going to make a joke about how nothing happened in the last week. But
And why don't we start with our beloved U of I here in town, or as Lisa, as you've taken to calling it the last couple of days?
The University of Interim.
We have yet another interim sports official at the University of Illinois after Mike Thomas was fired this week by the university, replaced on an interim basis by Paul Kowalczyk, who was the athletic director at Southern Illinois about a decade ago and then at Colorado State before being fired from there a few years back. Came to Illinois as an associate athletic director and seems like a good guy to take over in the interim. But now you've got a campus here in Urbana with an interim chancellor, an interim provost, an interim athletic director, and an interim head football coach.
And those are not small roles, shall we say. And I think there's been a lot of speculation, especially with the athletic director role. I mean, when we were here in the building, after the news came through yesterday via mass mail from the chancellor, it was sort of like my mouth opened. I was like, oh, my God. But then followed quickly by, well, that took a while. Like, it seemed to me that there was this expectation both on the campus and also in town and up in Chicago that it was sort of inevitable, especially as these reports were getting completed.
Yeah, I think so. Once that report was finalized, and I guess the university got that report last week from the law firm in Chicago, Francis Radelet, who handled that. Once that report came out, then it was just a matter of figuring out how to proceed, really. And when you've got an interim chancellor, Barb Wilson, I think, is doing the best she can in that role. But when you've got an interim chancellor who really doesn't have much of a background in athletics,
That's right. To
figure out how to proceed in something like this probably did take a few days just to figure everything out.
I think so. And the tone of her email was interesting, and I believe that email is publicly available. Mm-hmm. It's probably been on a multitude of websites. But I found the tone of it really positive and moving forward, but also you could tell it was kind of like, sports, like this, I'm coming from the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. I'm maybe not used. I think sports is so huge on a campus like the University of Illinois that sometimes it's hard to know exactly how to talk about it, especially in these kinds of situations. She kind of walked into the middle of it. You know, this was all starting to happen when she was in her previous position. So I thought, it's not so much the tone of the email, it's just sort of like, I'm feeling my way through this, like all the rest of the interim people are here on the campus, and I'm doing my best. But and we were also a little, we were talking a little bit in the office about the timing. Mm-hmm. Why not a Friday news dump? And I have my theories. I think in some ways, maybe the president is just all about like owning this stuff from the outset and just going, here it is, we're taking care of business, and we're moving forward, as opposed to trying to bury it on a Friday. I don't know. Do you have any feelings about what the timing was?
Yeah, no, I really don't know, because it seems that a lot of those previous things have happened on a Friday, and Friday afternoon. I specifically remember the day that Tim Beckman was fired. It was a week and a day before Illinois' first football game, and
That's
it was
right.
a very slow Friday in the newsroom. I was getting ready to go home for the week, and then the news release comes out, and there you go.
And you're not going home.
No, I wasn't going
right.
home. So it was a very interesting contrast to that. I do think in thinking – just kind of you talking about each person in their interim role. I think on the academic side, I think Barbara Wilson certainly has a great feel for the campus and everything like that.
Totally.
And I do think that they've got two good people in place kind of to be in those caretaker roles in athletics, in Paul Kowalczyk, who, as we mentioned, has athletic director experience at the Division I level.
Right.
Southern Illinois and Colorado State. Not Big Ten schools, but he's administered fairly sizable athletic programs.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So a good guy to have in that spot, and you know whether he's a candidate for the permanent position,
right.
Who knows.
Right.
But I think in, as far as that caretaker role, I think he's in a good spot to handle that. Same with Bill Cubitt on the football side. You know, he was a head coach at Western Michigan
mm-hmm.
for several years before he was let go from that role. So, again, maybe a little smaller university, but he has head coaching experience. He kind of knows what the deal is with
right.
press conferences and everything else. So a couple of good people to handle things until they can figure out where they want to go from here.
So is there anything in that? Have you read the whole report?
All 1,267
yeah.
pages.
Yeah,
no,
right.
I have not.
I know. When I saw the size of the PDF, I was like, okay, I'm going to rely on Twitter and other people to give me the gory details, although I was skimming like the executive summary.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything that you've read so far that you've read about that stands out to you? I have a couple things regarding Tim Beckman that I'm just like, okay, but I'm curious to hear. You go first.
Well, the thing stuck out to me was right from the introduction that this report on the football side was all about Tim Beckman,
mm-hmm.
basically. No one else was really, they were not critical of really anyone else in that report for the most part. It was all about Tim Beckman and the
yeah.
things that he did and pressured student athletes to play through injuries, et cetera, et cetera.
So what do you, I guess the problem that I'm having, I mean, I don't know, sometimes the way that I understand coaching to be at this level, particularly in the men's marquee revenue generating games like football and basketball, is that coaches are jerks. And, like, practice is a place for people to be jerks to people to get a rise out of them, a better performance. I mean, nothing – I didn't enjoy some of the things that I read, but none of it really surprised me, I guess. But then I think of my husband is a coach, and, like, he would rather die than ever say things like those kinds of things to any of his players, male or female. So, part of me was like, well, this is kind of how it is at this level. And then we can talk about pro football here in a minute. But it just, this sort of hatred of perceived weakness and shame, and then the shaming, mm-hmm. the shaming. I just thought, I was just like, whoa, So what kind of culture is that coach establishing on a team? And why are the players putting up with it, or do they think it's okay? Or so this is not an area that I am that familiar with. But to me, the culture of an organization is so important. And when that is sort of what is happening within an organization, can you be that surprised that performance isn't very good? I mean, does Urban Meyer treat his team this way? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to all of that. Most
oh come on, Brian.
Yeah, most Division I athletic programs now do not have open practices as used to be the case many years ago. I do think some of this is just a sign of changing times. For instance, I don't know if you've ever read John Feinstein's book, A Season on the Brink, about Bobby Knight spending a season.
I know of that book, but I've not read it.
It's a very interesting look, and I think that speaks to, and I think Bobby Knight was an extreme example even 30 years ago when this book was written, but I think that speaks somewhat to the way that times have changed when it comes to coaching. I think the more common theory, from 50s, 60s, even up to when Bobby Knight was prominent, was that that's how you got the best out of your players
mm-hmm.
was by that style of coaching, by berating them, by shaming them, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of that is changing. When you hear, for instance, when you hear John Gross talk at the podium and talk about his team and things after games, I don't think there's any less accountability,
mm-hmm.
but I think the way that a lot of coaches go about that now is a lot different. They don't think they get the best results from their players by browbeating them. They think it's by kind of lifting them up and encouraging them. You can do this. I expect
mm-hmm.
a lot out of you, but I know you can do it.
Do you think, okay, so maybe it's not acceptable from a coach on player perspective. Do you think coaches are also encouraging players to be cooler to each other and not, sometimes, I think of the Manning brothers and Archie Manning, their dad. You know, I'm talking about Peyton Manning and Eli Manning and how he'd tell them to, they'd get hurt and just put some dirt on it and keep going. And they would sort of goad each other into continuing to play. I mean, so do you think having a coach who is more of a positive, like, yes, I expect a lot out of you, but getting those good things is going to happen in a different way. Do you think they are also I'm talking about the team culture. So player to player, do you think they won't tolerate a lot of name calling, stuff like that? I mean, or is that something that they can't control?
Boy, I think the coach can control that type of thing if they want to. You know, that again, I think that goes to kind of the culture that you're talking about there. And I think there are different approaches out there. I think some coaches have different attitudes toward it than others. And especially I think with a sport like football, the head coach isn't going to see everything because you break up for position drills. You know, you've got your offensive lineman with the offensive line coach doing things like that. You've got the linebackers coach with the linebackers coaching those drills. Things are more scattered. So, the head coach isn't going to see every single thing that happens all the time. But I do think that the head coach is really the one who kind of sets the tone. And I do think, based on what's in that report, I think there were certainly some issues with the type of culture that Tim Beckman had established at Illinois.
Yeah, and again, as you mentioned, it's a very long and exhaustive report. Lots of footnotes and annotations. There's some photos. Lots going on in that report. But yeah, some of it to me was just sort of reinforced my decision maybe to and I think what you and I've talked about. I don't watch football anymore. I just don't. It's not something that appeals to me for a lot of reasons. I think the game is really violent. I don't like some of the worst of coaching culture. And then also at the pro level, you have situations like the one with what is his first name? Greg Hardy. That's right. Mm-hmm. So Dallas Cowboys. Why don't you go ahead and give the actual details? I'm going to.
Yeah. Basically, Greg Hardy was arrested and charged in a domestic violence case. I think it's been at least 2 years ago now.
Yeah, I think it has been.
It's been a while ago. And he was actually convicted in a bench trial by a judge. That ruling was appealed and overturned on appeal. And in fact, more recently, the charges have actually been expunged from Hardy's record.
Expunged.
Yes.
He was convicted.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That takes a lot to have that happen.
Yes.
How does he have that kind of clout? Is it the NFL coming in and just going, like, you guys got to clean this mess up?
Yeah.
Why him? Cowboys? Big
well,
money
actually,
machine there?
I think this dates back to when he was with Carolina Panthers.
Oh, that's right. You're right. But still.
Yeah. But still, yes, NFL, you wonder if, who knows what all went on there as far as how that got expunged. But I think this has bubbled up again because Deadspin in the last week or so released a lot of photos of the victim of this abuse after she came to police, and it can be pretty difficult to look at. I scrolled through those photos, and it was very difficult to do that and see some of the damage that Greg Hardy had done to this woman. And now you've got this dichotomy. You've got this stuff coming out with Deadspin this week, and at the same time, Greg Hardy on the field got off to a very good start for the Cowboys this season, so there's already been talk from the Cowboys owner, Jerry Jones, about signing him to a contract extension for millions and millions more dollars. It reminds me some of the Ray Rice situation, but honestly, I almost feel like this hasn't gotten as much play as that, and in part, you had that video.
The video, I think, was played over and over. It went beyond viral online, I would say. I mean, and it wasn't just for a day or, part of a day's news cycle. It was for days. You could not go through, and it was on television. So if you're watching TV, it's also there. So I think the video made the difference. Now I'm looking at, I couldn't stomach going through all the pictures, but even the first picture that you see on this Deadspin article, and we'll make sure we put a link, I think, when we post the podcast, it's sort of like, and there are other pictures, she's got bruises on her face. I mean, she didn't do this to herself.
No.
And, say whatever you want about women or men who put themselves in situation, there's drinking, what you're getting into, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't make this right.
No.
That does not make this right. it shouldn't be celebrated, however tacitly or openly, is, you know, to have his organization be like, well, this happened, but it's separate, and, you know, he's doing awesome on the field, so we're just going to extend his contract and basically reward him. You know, it calls up a lot of questions. And as I was saying earlier, I feel like Michael Vick got into way more trouble,
mm-hmm.
both in the court of public opinion and also with the NFL.
Yeah.
And that's right now, after reading this, and that's my perception. You know, obviously, the news and opinion, Facebook, everything just kind of coming at you from all directions. I mean, it's kind of hard to parse all that information, but that's how it feels to me.
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting, you know, as a sports fan, I've been a Dallas Cowboys fan, interestingly, since I was about 6 years old.
What is it about the Cowboys that inspires people not from Dallas to love them so much? I used to work with a guy from New Jersey who was obsessed with them.
For me, it was completely random. Of all things, it was back in 1982, I think it was. The Cowboys were playing the Washington Redskins in a playoff game. My dad hates the Cowboys, hates them with a passion. He's a Minnesota Vikings fan.
Oh.
And the game was on TV. I came into the room. I asked my dad who was playing. He told me. I asked him who he was rooting for. He said, Washington. I said, I'll root for the Cowboys.
And ever since then.
Just
so, as a lifetime fan, so when stuff like this happens on teams that you like, I mean, does that alter your perception of the team, especially like from a management perspective? I mean, I don't know where the coach is in all of this. Like,
yeah. Jerry Jones is one interesting guy. He is the owner. He's the general manager. He basically makes a lot of the decisions for the Dallas Cowboys, and has since he bought the team in the late 80s. When he first bought the team, one of the first things he did was fire Tom Landry, who had been the coach since the Cowboys were formed back in 1960. Now, I think Tom Landry was probably on his way out, and, you know, it was probably time. And then that was shortly followed thereafter by three Super Bowl wins in a four-season span in the 90s, and so everything was great. Really, in the last 20 years since then, the Cowboys have just been a very dysfunctional team.
Mm-hmm.
They spend a lot of money to win an average amount of games. They have not fared well in the playoffs when they've gotten there, and there's been more issues off the field, and this here, this though is really the first one to me that's really kind of made me question my fandom a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I still am going to root for the Cowboys to win, but overall I'm watching less football for some of the reasons you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I don't watch it a lot anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be avid, watch every game I could on Sundays. I'm not like that anymore. I'll turn it on, but if I've got some other things to do, whether that's yard work or whatever else on Sundays, I have
washing
no problem.
Washing your hair.
I have no problem just going outside and doing that as well.
Well, and my response to that is, out of all of the teams in the NFL, find me a functional one, a fully functional
mm-hmm.
one.
Yeah.
Where you don't have stuff happening off the field, stuff happening on the field, stuff with management, stuff with the fans, you know, the building of new stadiums and the money involved. I mean, there's so much involved with the NFL. Oh, we didn't even get a chance to talk about, the government paying sports leagues for stadium time for displays of patriotism. And we'll get to that another time, because that's not stopping anytime soon. Well, I heard maybe it kind of is going to grind to a halt, sort of, but we can talk later about how things have changed since you and I were kids, because like none of this ever happened. The way that my kids have grown up watching games is way different, I think. But anyway, find me a functional NFL team, like truly functional organization. I'm just not sure there is one. I'm not even sure in professional sports functionality on a certain level is even part of the game. It's all about money and winning, right? So,
yeah.
And if you're dysfunctional oh well.
Yeah, oh so, well, just win, baby, as Al Davis used to say so famously.
Just win, baby. So one last thing that I wanted to get to is I wanted to talk about this directive issued in the last couple of days by the United States Soccer Federation regarding heading the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a lot about in the last few weeks about head injuries playing a part in the deaths of some football players in high school mm-hmm. this fall. But soccer also, while you don't have the crushing hits and you're not hitting the ground or each other in quite the same way, there are still accidents. There are head-on-head collisions. Mm-hmm. You see people running into the goalposts sometimes or just hitting the ground really super hard. Doesn't happen that often. But also, players head the ball. Mm-hmm. And the older you get, the more expected you are, particularly in the boys' game. It's a little less in the girls' game up through high school, I would say. Once they're in college, they're heading the ball quite a bit. But the head is used in soccer as a legal way to hit the ball. Mm-hmm. So you can use your feet and your knees. Every part of your body, basically, except your arms, is fine. So people use their heads to pass the ball or otherwise direct the ball, hit it into the goal, break up a play, whatever. Mm-hmm. So this directive is a little bit of a surprise. In the last couple of years, there's been a little more research into soccer and rugby in particular because of two player deaths. There was a gentleman named Barry Taylor. He was a rugby player in Australia who didn't even know his own name by the time he passed away. He was 77. He had stage 4 CTE, or he was as far gone as you could get in terms of the brain injury from sports that was causing dementia. And then just today, I happened to be watching ESPN over lunch, and there was a documentary they were showing about Pat Grange, who was a professional or semi-pro amateur soccer player, played at the University of Illinois Chicago, actually. Mm. I think back in the early 90s, maybe early to mid 90s, judging by the size of the jerseys, I'm going to say the mid 90s or so. And he actually ended up with ALS.
Mm.
But then after they donated his brain to science, they discovered that he had stage 2. His brain was at stage 2. And in the New York Times article that I read, and also in this documentary, his parents were like, if we had known then that letting him head the ball so much, because he loved heading the ball from the mm-hmm. time he was 3. He was always heading the ball. 3 years old.
Wow.
He loved heading the ball. And so while the New York Times, well, I think people are trying to draw conclusions like maybe all of the heading of the ball caused the ALS, and I'm not really sure that that's correct.
That's a leap.
It was sort of shocking to read that this constant heading of the ball. And he had a couple of concussions during his playing years where he had to like not come back and he had stitches and things like that. I would say not too unusual for boys playing up through high school and into college and mm-hmm. and whatnot. So in some ways I was sort of like, yeah, this is cool, you know, no head balls until the age of 10. But then I was reading this New York Times article and they're talking about head balls between the age of 10 and 14. So like moving it up a little bit later was like one recommendation. And then there's another gentleman who says, you know, people's brains aren't really done developing until they're in their early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So head balls, at the level that my husband coaches and that my daughter has played at, I've seen people wearing protective headgear. It's not mm-hmm. a helmet.
It's like a little padding almost.
It's like padding.
Yeah.
Like, and it's right where typically when people head the ball, they're trying to head it on the front top of their head.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part of the head that they're using. So my daughter played with a player who had one of these, and I thought that she had to wear it because of a previous injury, but my daughter said that she was wearing it just as a protective measure so that she could use her head and not worry so much about it. So, you know, now I'm wondering, we were talking about over lunch, are they going to require headgear for everyone up through a certain age? Are they going to make it like volleyball where as long as you don't catch the ball, you can use whatever part you want while you move down the field, you know, so you can use your hands? Who knows?
Well, you think about when we were growing up, think about hockey, where mm-hmm. not everyone was required to wear helmets.
Man.
There were people like Gordie Howe playing in the late 70s where it was kind of grandfathered in, where if you came up before a certain time, you did not have to wear a helmet.
Right.
So Gordie Howe played until 1980. He didn't have to, but everybody else did. And then, those, you know, in helmets and face masks and everything else, and hockey, you know, the clear protection for hockey, that has become required. you think about all the other safety measures in race car driving, for instance. They've completely changed the race cars to make them much more safe in a crash, et cetera, et cetera. So I would not be surprised as there becomes more research available if youth soccer players would have to wear some kind of head protection.
And I wonder, too, if that will then make its way into the college game mm-hmm. and into the professional game. You know, even some of the millionaires, as we like to call them, the gentlemen who play on the weekends in foreign countries, you know, I think Arsenal's keeper wears that.
Yeah, is that Petr Cech?
I believe that's his name,
yeah, he used
yes.
to be with Chelsea, yeah.
Right, right. So, you know, and part of it is players coming in at top speed, they're going to run into you. Keepers rarely use their heads on the ball. Mm-hmm. But there's the goalposts to worry about, and there's other players and collisions. And so, you know, I got to think that that's pretty smart. And as the mother of a player, I will fully confess that I am okay with her not liking heading the ball, like avoiding it. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with that because it's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's too many hits. And don't start your kid at the age of three, maybe heading the ball. Maybe that's just not the best idea in the mm-hmm. world. You know, but also investing in that protective headgear. I can't see, it's not going to be limiting the game. It's not eliminating head balls. It's not stopping anybody from doing anything. It's really mitigating potential future damage.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll see.
So
how
wear
that
a
goes.
Helmet, everybody.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if it's good enough for hockey players, it could be good enough for soccer players as well. So we'll see how that develops in the days, weeks, years to come.
Indeed.
Well, I think that'll just about do it for this edition of The Bandwagon. As we mentioned at the top, if you have any topics you'd like us to cover, hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Bmolene, W-I-L-L.
And I'm at Lisa Braltz.
Thanks so much for listening to The Bandwagon. Take care.
Thank you.